it's really very special for me to stand here again. As Myra said and read, I was a student here, 95, 96. Well, a lot of things have changed since then. Rav Meir hasn't. I guess he's gone. He's not here now. But he was here. I said hello to him. He said hello to me before, and that's. Oh, he's in there. That was very special. And I spent a lot of many happy hours studying in this Beit Midrash, and in this place. And it's really very meaningful for me to be back here. And I really appreciate the invitation, and really very happy to be here. The two teachers actually who I mentioned in that. In that little vignette that Myra read out, are no longer here. I don't know if you remember them. I'm pretty sure, if my memory serves, Yosef Leibowitz was one, and Kalman Newman was the other, and they were the ones who were debating with each other. And Yosef, who was during that year was my Mikra teacher here, ended up being my Masadir Kedushin, the rabbi who married me, because ended up my wife also studied with him in another context. So a lot of very powerful personal. Connections with this place, and you guys are very lucky to be studying here for the year, or for longer. The other thing that I'm very excited about today is that I discovered recently that my smartphone can control my computer. it just somehow got disconnected. Damn. Well, so much for that. I'm gonna have to do manually. I want to give you a little insight into some of my thinking in the work that I do. Both as part of this program Kesher Chadash that Myra mentioned, and also in general in my research and work on Israel education. And I want to start by having us think a little about Israel, and here's one particular introduction to Israel. Okay, I'll read it out, and my question is going to be, who do you think wrote this, or where did it come from? Israeli society is sick. I'm not asking if Israeli Jews have forgotten how to be Jews, but if they've forgotten how to be decent human beings. The Israeli Arab population has suffered for years from discrimination in budget allocation, education, infrastructure, and industrial and trade areas. Okay, let's have a few thoughts. Ari Shavit, are there other ideas? Oh, you gave it away. All right. We've got a smart student in the room. Yeah, these are two, actually, they're from two different speeches. The first two are from one, and the second is from another. Speeches that he gave in very close proximity to each other in just this past October, President Ruby Rivlin, about Israel. So obviously, that's not the only thing that President Rivlin thinks about Israel, and obviously President Rivlin thinks a lot of other good things about Israel and Israeli society. But keep that in your head, and then keep this in your head as well. Actually, maybe we can even go to the website, have a screenshot here. But here's another introduction to Israel. I'm sure that some of you might know this this website, sizedoesntmatter.com. Anyone ever come across it? It's called Size Doesn't Matter. It's a website, sizedoesntmatter.com. It's an Israel advocacy or Hasbara, I guess, website. At least that's how I would define it. They may define it themselves differently. I'm not sure how well this comes up on the screen, but it says, this is a screenshot, obviously, of Tel Aviv at night. In recent years, Israel has been increasingly recognized as one of the world's greatest innovation hubs and most dynamic economies. We have provided this backgrounder to summarize just a few of the remarkable trends that have led to Israel being referred to by experts as the startup nation, and it goes on to about NASDAQ and so on and so forth. So, I want to suggest that this is the core tension that we face in Israel education today. And it's much more complicated than that, and we can spend a semester or more or a life thinking about those complexities and nuances and how, when, and why. But I would say that given that it's a huge oversimplification of the issue, still pretty much every discussion about Israel education, whether that's a curricular discussion, a pedagogical discussion, a philosophical discussion, and we'll get into some of those shortly, but it comes down to this tension between the idealized and the real. Okay, the idealized Israel and the real Israel. Which one of those two approaches, each of those two approaches represents one end of that spectrum, right? Ruby Rivlin's taken out of context, obviously, quote about the situation with Israeli Arabs in Israeli society, the Size Doesn't Matter website. Those are the sort of two extremes, the idealized and the real. And every discussion we might have about Israel education is going to come down to this tension. And I want to share with you what some of those questions might be. There are educational questions. Here are a bunch of the educational questions that that I think about a lot and that I think we should think about. Which story do we tell? Right, when we do Israel education, when we teach about Israel, when we talk about Israel in the diaspora, and in Israel for that matter, what story should we tell? Do we tell Ruby Rivlin's story? God, it's not the entirety, obviously, of Ruby Rivlin's story, but do we tell that, the real story, the gritty, difficult, frustrating, upsetting, sometimes challenging aspects of Israeli society? Or on the other hand, the beautiful, fantastic, exciting, inspiring parts of Israeli society? Which is the story of Israel that we tell? You know? And when, where, and how do we introduce the less attractive stuff, right? If we want to say that, well, at some point we do want people to grapple with the tough stuff, but when? Which context, which educational context, which ages, which people? Do they have to have do they have to do one story first and then the next? Do we have to expose people first to the great stuff about Israel, the stuff that gives us goosebumps, the stuff that makes us love being here, the stuff that makes us want to come and study here or live here? And only then, when we're really sure that people are kind of committed, then we reveal the other stuff. How do context, age, and background play a role, right? Do we only let people grapple with the tough stuff when they're a certain age, when they're 14 or 15 or 20 or 30 or I don't know when? And can you integrate them? Is there a sweet spot? How can you do these two things together? Right? How can you do, is there a way to do these two things together? So those are the educational questions that really motivate me and that really I spend a lot of time thinking about and working on. And they're not just educational questions, they're communal questions, communal issues. These are just some of the things that have come up in the past, I would say, year. The whole furore over Open Hillel and the Open Hillel movement, obviously that discussion, I would argue, is also about that core tension between idealized and real and how we grapple with it. All of the kerfuffle with J Street and the Federation system, the fundraisers network, the role of the American Jewish community in religious pluralism issues in Israeli society came up again just a few weeks ago. I don't know if you read when a bunch of conservative and reform rabbinical students were in the Knesset, and they tried to daven mincha there in the Knesset synagogue, and they weren't allowed. It comes up every few weeks. These kinds of issues come up in one way or another. Again, it's about that tension of idealized and real. There was a report that came out about a year and a half ago, by Steve Cohen and Jason Gitlin, about the reticence of rabbis to talk about Israel from the pulpits. They discovered that many rabbis are just afraid to touch Israel from the pulpit. They won't talk about it. It's the third rail of American synagogue life, because many rabbis will say, well, I'm not going to touch Israel from the pulpit. Whatever I say about Israel, somebody in my community will be upset, right? If I speak about Israel and I speak about it from the people hear me coming from the right, then the left wing on my board will give me a hard life and will make my life misery. But if I'm saying anything that is heard to come from the left, then the right wing members of my board will give me a hard life and make my life misery. So I'm just not going to touch Israel. I'll talk about Tikkun Olam. I'll talk about Kashrut. I'll talk about existential theological issues. I ain't touching Israel more than my job's worth. It's an enormous problem. Yeah, I'm going to speak for like a few minutes and then I'm going to open up for discussion. Okay, so let me. I'll say a few things and then I told you that I should have said this thing with. I'll speak for around 20 minutes, and then we'll talk for 20, 30 minutes. Oh, okay, go on. Okay. Okay, so let's come to that. I hear that question. Let's come to it at the end. I appreciate the question. And the tension between Israel advocacy and Israel education, which I think we'll talk more about later, maybe. But the thing that worries me most of all is Alyssa. So, who's it? Is there an Alyssa here in the room? Oh, there's three Alyssas, two Alyssas. I'm really sorry. Don't take it personally. Because Alyssa also wasn't her real name, so, you know, so you're okay. If I ever write about you, you'll end up being, you know, Andrew. So Alyssa was a student of mine, and this is a true story, real person, and I think this is of all of the things that I've spoken about so far. This is I write about this. I start the book with this vignette. This is the thing that worries me most of all. I'm going to read it out. Alyssa is a poster child for Jewish education in almost all respects. I know that you're not meant to read out what's written on the PowerPoint slide. You know they always say don't read, but I'm doing it because it's worth hearing it as well. She was very involved in USY. Conservative movement's youth group. She teaches in her local synagogue school, and she's now a master's student in Jewish education at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. This is some years ago, so neither Myra nor Sam nor Erica actually know this person. She's checked off all the boxes that we set up for young American Jews, but she isn't interested in Israel. "I just don't need Israel," Alyssa tells me. "I have a rich Jewish life in every respect. I love Shabbat. I love my community. I have a great Jewish social life and many Jewish and non-Jewish friends. I enjoy studying Jewish texts and find meaning in many of the ritual elements of Jewish life. It's not that I have anything against Israel. I just don't need it. I have a perfectly rich Jewish life without it." So this is a, in a way, this is a personal kind of vignette which gives a taste of why many of those rabbis are afraid or unwilling to talk about Israel from the pulpit. Because it's not about whether you're right or left, or whether you're pro or con, or whether you're positive or negative. It's that the inability to create a kind of an educational and identity framework that allows you to live in that difficult space leaves people just rejecting Israel because it's just dealing with it is too complicated. Israel is difficult. It's a pain in the neck. You know, your non-Jewish friends criticize you because when you want to talk about it, when you mention anything about Israel on your Facebook feed, you know, World War III breaks out. When you want to talk about it with your Jewish friends and you want to say anything maybe critical of it, then they get upset. It's just too difficult and too painful and too complicated and too much of a pain in the neck, and so I'm just going to check out of it. Okay? I've got plenty of other stuff going on in my Jewish life. You know, I can be a Jew, and frankly, it's easier to be a Jew without really grappling with Israel in a serious, ongoing way. And I think this is a phenomenon that we see more and more in American, especially in American Jewry. There's also research by Steve Cohen and others that supports this. I'll talk more about research if you want during the question session. That there's differences in some of the schools of research, and some of the research on birthright points in perhaps a slightly different direction. I'm happy to talk about that in more detail later if anybody wants. But basically, I would argue that that this is the real specter that should be worrying us all from wherever we're coming from. And my argument is that Israel education needs to find a way to allow the Alyssas of the world to grapple with Israel, to engage with Israel, to be involved in Israel, and to find ways to construct that conversation so that even when that conversation gets difficult and even when that conversation brings up conflicts between them and their friends, their family, themselves, that we provide them with a kind of educational and identity framework that allows that to happen successfully. That's really, if I were to sum up everything that my book is about, I think, and that my work is about, I would say it's about that. I'll say a few brief words about the book because I brought a few here if anybody wants to buy them later. 50 shekels. Good discount. Cheaper than on Amazon.com. Here are some of the questions that I grapple with in the book. I'll say a few words about each of these questions. And then I've got a few more slides left, and then we'll talk. So one question I think about a lot, and that is that first question. And I'll say that the answer is not, it sounds like it's a rhetorical question, that first question, that the answer is yes. Obviously I'm going to say yes. But it's not always, you know, I'm not so sanguine to say that 100% the answer to that first question is always yes. In other words, engagement with a real Israel does not always lead to a robust and committed relationship with Israel. It's engagement with the tough stuff has to be handled in a thoughtful way, in a nuanced way, in a pedagogically reflective way, in a way which is also exposing people to the good things and is within a kind of context of support and of Jewish and of sort of profound Jewish relationship with Israel. So even though I want to argue with that first question that ultimately the answer is yes, and ultimately I have a kind of a faith, if you like, or a core educational belief that the answer to that first question is yes, it's a complicated yes, and it's not an easy yes. One of the other questions that I talk about in the book is what we mean by love, as you see in the title. And one of the questions, when we talk about Israel education, and you see this across, if you go into any more or less any Jewish educational organization's website, a day school, a synagogue school, a summer camp, an Israel trip, they'll talk about loving Israel. We want students to love Israel as being kind of one of the goals of organizations. But I think we have to do a lot more thinking about what do we mean by love. I won't say too much about that right now. Because it's in the book, and I'm happy to talk about it often if you want. But thinking about what we mean by love is a really important question for me. And related to that, what's the place of anger and frustration in a relationship with Israel? I'm going to talk more about that in a minute on one of the later slides. But we have anger and frustration in all of our relationships, with in all of our mature relationships that we have with any person or anything. And what's the place of those things in our relationship with Israel? And finally, a more specific educational question I don't really want to go into today, which is, what do we learn about progressive, what do we learn from progressive educational thought about Israel education, about from constructivism and from other philosophical approaches to education? I think that we won't talk about that today. This is the definition of Israel education that I use in the book and that I use in my work and in my life. I'm going to give you this definition, and then I'm going to bring three parts of it and talk about it for another few minutes, and then I'll stop. So I argue that American Jewish Israel education should be a series of conversations about the complexities of Israeli society, and in those conversations, American Jews should be empowered to dialogue and disagree with Israelis and with each other about a variety of issues, including political ones. Each of those four italicized words is a really kind of core part of my philosophy of Israel education. I think that conversation is a critical part of any education, and I'll talk a little bit later in a few minutes about the idea of machloket and conversation. The complexities of Israel society, I think you've already gathered, is something which I think that people should be involved in. And this notion about empowerment to dialogue is critical, because I think that one of the things that that Alyssa is looking for is that permission to be involved, that permission to be involved in a productive way, that permission to have her voice be heard in the conversation. I think that my definition of Israel education requires American Jews to be involved in all of the difficult conversations about Israel, and to be able to have their voices heard in those conversations. I believe that there's an educational thinker called Deborah Meyer, who I don't know if you guys ever come across, with Judy or any of that work. She's a writer and a school principal, who's written a lot about teaching in the inner city school systems in New York and in Boston. And she has this great phrase: learning is telling. Learning is mostly telling. In other words, it's through the action of telling, of articulating and developing our opinions, of being kind of forced to take a stand, being forced to say, this is what I believe, that's actually how we learn. And that you don't learn by listening passively to somebody, you learn by being forced to engage and being forced to develop your own position. Again, we'll come back to what that means in terms of chevruta and machloket in a minute, but I think you can probably already see that feels kind of right in a sense of the kind of learning that goes on in this Beit Midrash. And I think we need to apply it to Israel as well. Okay, three more little things I want to just mention, which kind of come from the book and from my work, and then I'll pause for questions. So I want to talk about passion, anger, and caring. I want to talk about machloket, and I want to talk about red lines. Okay, passion, anger, and caring. I think you need all three in a relationship with Israel. I think you need passion, that's for sure. I want people to be passionate about Israel, and I want people to feel passionate about their relationship with Israel. That's easy, right? That's obvious. That stands for reason. I want people to care about Israel, and I use the word care in a slightly technical sense here. There's a feminist philosopher of education called Nell Noddings, an American writer about education, who uses this language of caring as a part of the education of her educational philosophy, and it's her work is based on Martin Buber's work on in terms of sort of I-thou kind of relationships. But she talks about caring in education as being having a kind of deep, she calls it engrossment, a deeper attachment, engagement, deep relationship with between the teacher and the learner, or between different people in the educational system. So I want people to care about Israel, not in that sense of caring as kind of caring on a one-way thing, but kind of caring as in being deeply engrossed in the subject matter, deeply engrossed in the people and the place and the society of Israel. That's what Noddings means by caring. A deep kind of I-thou engagement with Israel. And also anger. Anger is the hardest of them all, because when you think about Israel education, you think about what it means to develop relationships with Israel, anger seems maybe the most counterintuitive of these things. But I would argue that if there's not something in Israel that you're angry with, then you don't know Israel very well. I think that's probably the case for all of us who know Israel well. There's something, at least one thing that we're angry about. There's got to be. If there isn't anything that you're angry about, then that's a sign that you don't know Israel so well. So I want people to be angry. I'm not afraid of anger. And I think as educators, we shouldn't be afraid of anger. I think that anger, again, when it's handled correctly and when it's handled thoughtfully in an educational way, then anger can be actually a very positive educational modality. Maybe in terms of, I won't say anything about Westheimer right now. He's somebody I write about in the book, and I'll skip over that thing. I'll just show, this is a cute thing, that the hand-wringing exercise that I sometimes do. Maybe I'll do it with you guys, because it's fun. It's really easy, and it's a way to show very very tangibly the core truth, or the core, truth is a hard word, but the core feasibility of this approach. So let's do this. I'm guessing that most people here are Americans. Yeah? Okay. So let's do this. Raise your hand if you love America. Okay, come on. I also love America. Okay. Okay. Keep your hands raised. Keep your hands raised if you love America. Okay? Okay. Watch the hand. Now watch the hands. Okay? Now, I want you to keep your hand raised. Okay? Keep your hand raised. North America. Fine, we can give you Canada as well. I'll give you Canada. Okay? Okay. I know that probably now every Canadian in the room hates me. So that's fine. Okay. Keep your hand raised if America or Canada have never done anything that makes you angry. Okay. So I often do that with younger kids. It's a very kind of clear and easy way of showing that it's okay to love something and be angry with it. Right, it's okay to love a country or a person. Right, anybody who's married probably knows that you know, you can love your spouse, and there are still sometimes things that your spouse does that make you angry or frustrated or difficult. Certainly, if you have kids, that's the case. But anger can definitely, I think, be part of a relationship, and I think we have to be less afraid of anger being part of our relationship with Israel. Okay, I hope that people are going to be able to read this on the screen. It's a little small. The second thing I want to just to talk about is machlok el Hashem Shemaim, and here I really feel that this Beit Midrash is a place to talk about it. I'm sure this is a brighter that you guys have learned or not a brighter. They talk about a brighter, a piece of a Gemara. If you haven't, then this is a great opportunity to do it. So I'm going to read it in English, even though I know that here in Parades we should be going through the Hebrew, but it's a great piece. So Reish Lakish dies, and Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, just in case you haven't come across it, are two great chevrutas for years and years. There's a great story about how they met. That's not what we're going to get into today, but they've been chevrutas for years and years and years, and Rabbi Yochanan was plunged into deep grief. Said the rabbis, who shall go to ease his mind? Let Rabbi Elazar ben Padat go, whose disquisitions are subtle. So he went and sat before him, and on every dictum uttered by Rabbi Yochanan, he said, there is a brighter that supports you. Rabbi Yochanan said, are you like Reish Lakish, the son of Lakisha? When I stated a law, Reish Lakish used to weigh 24 objections, which I gave him 24 answers, which consequently led to a fuller comprehension of the law. In other words, when I sat with Reish Lakish and I would say something, he didn't agree with me the whole time. He didn't say, oh, yes, Rabbi, you're right. Yes, Rabbi Yochanan. Yes, Rabbi Yochanan. For everything I would argue, he would give me 24 reasons that I was wrong. And I would then give him 24 reasons why I thought he was wrong. And that's what led to our learning. That machloket, l'shem shemayim, that's what led to our learning. You always say, oh yes, a bright has been taught that supports you. He went on rending his garments and weeping, where are you, O son of Lakisha? Where are you, son of Lakisha? And he cried thus until his mind was turned, and thereupon the rabbis prayed for him and he died. It's an amazing, amazing story. And it's one of the stories that at places like Parades, it becomes part of the DNA. I mean, at least it was when I was here. I presume it still is. it's what's called the DNA of a place like this, and the DNA of other places where great Jewish learning happens. Because we know that machloket is an amazing, amazing part of Jewish tradition and Jewish life. And we know there's nothing more powerful than two people sitting over a text and disagreeing over it and saying, I think Rashi's right and I think Rashi's wrong. Or or even looking at Rashi and Ibn Ezra arguing with each other over a different text, and Ibn Ezra saying that Rashi's wrong. And you know, that's what Jewish life is about. It's about machloket l'shem shemayim. And I think that we've kind of forgotten that in our work on Israel education. And I think in Israel education, we're so scared, and people can ask questions about that scared, why we're scared, and there's real reasons to be scared. But we're so scared of kind of getting into the difficult things that we've lost that sense of that ability to have machloket l'shem shemayim be part of Israel education. Okay, this is the final thing, and then I, as I promised, we'll have plenty of time for questions. I think we have to stop worrying about red lines. I think one of the reasons why many young American Jews get frustrated with contemporary manifestations of Israel education is because they feel that they're constantly being tested to see are their views kosher or not? Are they within the red lines or not? I had a student, not in your cohort, who defined herself as an anti-Zionist. She came into the program saying that this is clearly, she's an anti-Zionist, she was an amazing person, very smart person, a real kind of classic diasporist, kind of Bundist, Yiddishist Jew, defined herself as an anti-Zionist. And I recruited her very hard to get her into the program. And I was really happy that she did do the program in the end, and she came out of the program also as an anti-Zionist. And the question I always ask when we had conversations with this person, and when we spoke about, as a group, as a cult, about, well, what does it mean to have people who are committed to Israel and committed to Israel education and Zionists about it, in conversation with somebody who explicitly defined herself as an anti-Zionist? And my only question to ask was, is this conversation about Israel enriched because of this person being part of it? And with this particular person, the answer was always yes. So I think we have to stop being worried about red lines and stop being worried about, is somebody a Zionist or not a Zionist, and what does that mean? And let's kind of livdoka tzitziot shelahem. Let's check their tzitziot, as it were, as their Zionist tzitzit. I think the question we have to ask is the conversation about Israel enriched by this person being part of our conversation? I think once you understand the conversation in that way, then it becomes we stop worrying about red lines, and instead it's much more about the conversation, about the richness of the conversation about Israel. Because at the end of the day, I think that's what we're looking for. That's what Alyssa is looking for. Alyssa and people like her are looking for a way to have a conversation about Israel which is compelling and exciting and powerful and sometimes frustrating and sometimes challenging and not easy and real and honest and authentic. And at the end of the day, that has to be our educational goal. Okay, so I'll say a few words to kind of finish at the very end, but I would love now to have time for questions and discussion and machloket l'shem shemayim. I think that's ultimately what we should be doing. So feel free to disagree with me, because people usually do. Hi, and tell me your name as well. Hi, Karen. That's a good question. I think there are probably two types of Alyssa. So one type is one who is kind of, the reason that she's kind of gone into apathy is because she's had so much, like, she's been involved. And by the way, Alyssa has been to Israel, and she's spent time here. But I think people, it's like, some people go through the stage of like, it's just too difficult. And I hear this from people about with Facebook, especially has made this, I think, this phenomenon much, much more acute, which is that anytime I say anything on Facebook about Israel, like I said before, World War III breaks out. I'm just not going to touch Israel on my online life. So I think Alyssa's obviously that this is a pre-Facebook quote, well, maybe the beginnings of Facebook. But I think there's one kind of person is one who's tried to get involved, got involved, and it's just so kind of like the grief of being involved and the kind of the intensity of being involved is just so. Annoying and difficult, and they'd rather just check out because it's like an easy, it's a path of least resistance, as it were. There is another kind of Lissa, you're probably right, another kind of American Jew who's just not involved in Israel in any way because they've never had the opportunity to be involved in it, it's not part of their radar screen. But I think that second type is less likely to say these other things. Whereas a typical assimilated American Jew who is not going to say, less likely to say, to have all these things like Shabbat and a rich Jewish life and Jewish texts. I think that Steve Cohen and other researchers have showed this, essentially, that people who have less, in general, have less Jewishly rich lives in general, are also likely to have less Israel engagement in general, and those two things are basically correlated. So, but what I'm talking about here in particular is a person who has had the opportunity to step into the Israel world, has had a Jewish, and still has an engaging Jewish life, but is kind of making that separation between them. My answer to Alyssa, our regular chatzah to why Israel and how Israel can play a powerful role in an American Jewish identity, is that I think that it can, grappling with Israel and the modern state of Israel gives us, as modern Jews, questions to think about and questions for Judaism to think about that we've never had in the past 2,000 years, and those questions are very exciting. So what does it mean as a Jew for me to kind of expand my notion of Jewishness beyond the Beit Midrash, no offense, beyond purely religious issues, beyond purely spiritual and communal issues, into questions of public space, civic religion, ethnicity and nationality, and those. What does it mean to kind of have Judaism expand itself to grapple with some of the main questions that the world is facing today? That, I think, is very exciting and can be made very exciting for people like Alyssa. That would be that. I mean, I've got more to say, but that's all regular chat. Let's go to this guy in the corner here, and then I'll bounce between the sides of the room. Just tell me your name. Josh. Hi, Josh. Yeah, it's a great question. It's a question that often comes up, and it's a tough question. Look, I think that diaspora Jews need to be much more assertive in a direct way in the way that they grapple with questions of religious life in Israel, especially when it relates to diaspora Jews. I think that the questions of religious life, the questions of Jewish, of manifestations of Jewishness, are fantastic and exciting questions. And when Israelis are exposed to them through direct kind of interaction with diaspora Jews who believe in them, Israelis get excited about them as well. Israelis who have not previously been interested in Jewishness and not previously been interested in these kinds of questions, when they encounter people like Myra, they get to, who are committed to egalitarianism, I don't want to kind of out you on anything, committed to egalitarianism and committed to kind of to pluralistic conceptions of Jewish life and to co-educational text study and etc., etc., etc. That's very powerful for Israelis as well. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Maybe you're asking a different question, but let's take the Kotel, which is a kind of in many ways a boring example. It's like a kind of cliched example, but on some level maybe it stands for things as well. Okay, so what should the relationship between a diaspora Jew, an American Jew, goes to the Kotel and doesn't feel that they have a place there? I'm talking about the quote unquote regular Kotel. Let's leave the new. The new platform, we can talk about that as well. But let's say you go to the Kotel, the traditional picture postcard of the Kotel as an American Jew, and it's like it feels alien to me, it doesn't feel right to me. So what's the role of the American Jew, of an American Jewish community with regard to that? Until now, most of the work that's been done around questions of religious pluralism and so on and so forth, and that had been done on the high levels, right? You have Rabbi Rick Jacobs, who was speaking to President Rivlin and Naftali Bennett, and trying to kind of figure out all these compromises on these kind of high political levels. And American Jews are kind of meant to sort of sit there and wait until this is resolved. And until then, that's not part of my relationship with Israel as a ordinary synagogue going American Jew who comes to Israel on my synagogue mission or on for a bar mitzvah trip or whatever it might be. So I would want to create Israel educational contexts where those American Jews are given the chance to be empowered to engage in conversations with Israelis, with a diverse group of Israelis, about what they feel about that, and talk about that, and create those kinds of those one-on-one interactions where the American Jews can feel that they're having their voices heard. Go on, you have about everything. I think that we have to have a lot of faith in this notion of people of empowering people to have their voice heard. And when somebody is empowered, when somebody feels that my voice is being heard, and it may be that Israelis will disagree with me, and it may be that at the end of the day, Israel is not going to change. And by the way, that's probably the reality. I mean, Israel is not suddenly going to turn tomorrow into an egalitarian, pluralistic, kind of liberal Western democracy. That's not where we're going as a country. And if you think that the only way you can have a relationship with Israel is for Israel to suddenly, like that, turn into like Massachusetts or Vermont, then you're in the wrong game. And you need to kind of readjust your expectations, because that's not where Israel is going. Okay, Israel's probably going more in the direction of Turkey, and Turkey is like a more interesting model in a lot of ways for what Israel, you know, might look like than Vermont or Massachusetts. So, but then the question is, if I've got an American Jew from Vermont and from Massachusetts, and I want them to have a relationship with Israel, because I do, so I think that the moment that American Jew from Vermont ceases to have a relationship with Israel, then we have a real problem as a Jewish people. So Israelis may not agree with that American Jew. Israelis may not change their mind. Israelis may not want to change, but that sense of having your voice heard and being listened to is really, really important and empowering. And that might be the way to save a relationship. Again, there's a lot of analogies you can make from one-on-one relationships, where about the power of listening to somebody, the power of listening within a relationship, even when you disagree with somebody, is really important. So let's come here. Yeah. Tell me your name.
Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Hey, I didn't say that. Don't put words into my mouth. Okay, so it's a long answer. But it's really important just to go back to the premise of the question, because I don't want to be misunderstood or misheard. That's really important. I'm not saying, and I certainly do not believe and will not try to argue that anger on its own is or should be or can be the basis for a profound relationship with Israel. It can't be. And I think one of the things, if I go back to that anti-Zionist student who Erica and I both know, one of the things that I'm kind of very proud of in the program is that I could certainly see that kind of person getting sucked into a relationship with Israel that was only based on anger, and then that would then, I think, lead to disengagement very quickly. I think that you need to have all three of these things, at least all three of those things. And absolutely passion and caring, I think, are critical components along with anger. It's important. Sometimes people like mishear me or misconstrue me, or maybe I don't communicate well enough, but it's really important. It's not just about anger, but I also would argue that you can't just be about passion and caring. You know, I think one of the ways which we've typically done Israel education and Israel engagement until now has been to be very scared of anger and to say, oh, you've got to kind of, you should feel great about Israel and give money to Israel and support Israel. And if you're angry about anything, well, I'm sorry, we have no space for you here in our community. And talk about, you know, and I think that's the mistake on the other hand. So I think you want to try to integrate all three together. So the answer to how you do that skip the question or sidestep the question, but it's a long, complicated answer. So I don't want to do it an injustice by like giving a one sentence answer. It's complicated. It's very complicated, and it requires a semester of learning about Israel education. I'm going to go to this side of the room again.
David.
Hi, David.
Good,
okay, and let's go over now. That's a great question. I don't have an answer for it. And I would say that it's a question that I struggle with myself, professionally, without going into too many details. And it's a great question, and I don't have an answer. Until, yeah. Well. wait for Mashiach, or wait for the right foundation to come along who really is going to take this and run with it. But yeah, it's a question. Yeah. Yeah. Hi. What's your name? Hi, Shira. It's a great question. These are all great questions. Look, there's a real world out there, is what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right. And there's a real world where in Europe, I mean, Europe today is where, chas v'chalila, but, where America might be tomorrow in terms of the attitude towards Israel on campus and the place of Israel or place of Zionism in the public sphere. I don't know if you saw, there's a piece about a journalist in Sweden who walked around with a kippah on his head in some neighborhood and was assaulted and spat at and got, America's a far, far away from that yet, but maybe on some campuses it's not. And certainly on some campuses, when you use the word Zionism, you've been there more recently than I have, but I hear what you're saying. So, look, I'll say a couple of things. The campus situation is a subsection of this larger question, and it probably does require, what was the word used, strategic thinking and political with a small p, political thinking. Let's say strategic thinking, and the question about how do you take this approach and make it right for a particular campus situation. I think that I haven't been on an American campus for a long time. Certainly, I haven't as a student ever. So it might be that I can't speak to this, but what I would hope would be that in situations when you're dealing with somebody who can't listen to you, then I think that probably all of this is moot, right? And this is not relevant for a situation when you're on campus and there's a virulent kind of shrieking match between, Islamic fundamentalist group who's like trying to kind of, BDS Israel out of the campus or whatever it is. Like in those kind of like very shrill situations, probably you need somebody else to come tell you what to do with that, not me. I think that this approach is really important when you're sitting down in a bar with somebody who's not an Islamic fundamentalist BDS proponent, but is a non-Jewish friend who has got a friend who is an anti-fundamentalist BDS, and you're sitting down having a conversation over a beer with that person, talking about how you as a Zionist relate to Israel. And I think in that situation, then I think this is really important for them to hear people say, look, I'm a Zionist, I'm committed to Israel. Israel is, I think, a fantastic place, and here's why I'm going to go and spend the next year studying there, or here's what happened to me when I was there last year, and here's why it's an important part of my identity as a Jew. And look, I also am willing to kind of put on the table the stuff about Israel that I think is problematic, or I understand at least why other people find it problematic, and I understand that there may be that there's a certain amount of truth in some of the things that are said in the New York Times, whatever it might be. But let's talk about it as grown-ups, and let me try to give it context, and let me try to say why I find that disturbing, what I'm doing to change it, and why other Israelis are trying to change it, whatever issue that might be. So I think in any kind of like situation where, it comes down to one of the other sides about is the conversation enriched? If you're in a conversation with somebody who you think that person's ready to listen and engage, then I think this approach is really, really important. Because at the end of the day, this in that conversation, the other person won't listen to you if all you're ever going to say is, Israel is just perfect and can do no wrong, And because then you create kind of this kind of either-or situation. So my belief, and again, you know, this is the one place where I'm not speaking from personal direct knowledge. So what I'm saying now is a hunch, and you might tell me that I'm wrong, which is fine. But my hunch would be that in a situation where you were able to talk with somebody in a kind of that non-shrill setting with a non-Jew who's like, you know, you're trying to kind of like talk about it, then this thing could be very important. And especially, and also, of course, with within the Jewish community, I think this approach is really important. Yeah, tell me your name. It's a great question. I've come across this is a situation I've come across directly. I mean, I spend most of my summers I spend at a particular summer camp in the States, a Ramah camp, and obviously there you have a huge number of shlichim there, and I've had these kinds of conversations. I've made this kind of presentation with shlichim, sometimes shlichim get very it's hard for shlichim to hear this kind of thing for all the reasons that you just spoke about, because most of them are either still in the army or just out of the army, and a lot of things are very raw. And they're young as well. I mean, that's another thing as well. Without being patronizing, but yeah. So the one way that I found that one of the ways that I found to be helpful with that is to create situations where different shlichim can have conversations with each other, machloket conversations with each other in front along with Americans. Sometimes you have to start with things which are the less raw and less difficult things. So I mean, you know, we haven't mentioned, by the way, the conflict with the Palestinians. I don't think I mentioned that at all explicitly here. Clearly, that's one of the most raw issues that people get all kind of like difficult. But so I would put that to the side to begin with. I would say, let's take an issue about, I don't know, let's say about economic issues in Israel, or about maybe the religious pluralism issues, or about some particular social issue. Okay, and then create a situation where you have one shaliach and another shlicha or shaliach, talking with each other and giving them that sort of permission and the space to disagree with each other. Have a panel debate about something. It could be on a Friday night after a thing within Pulat Sevet, whatever it might be. Oh, hello. And then when did you get there? And that is a way of bringing shlichim into a space where they can see, okay, part of my role as a shaliach in this group of American Jews is to show how I can be in machlok l'shem shemaim with another Israeli, and to show that Israelis disagree with each other, and we can sometimes disagree with each other very strongly and still hang out together afterwards, and we can do that about a variety of issues, you know, and that's a way in which you can, I think, begin to get Israelis into this space. But it's difficult. I mean, I think the questions are really bamakom. A couple more questions, let's say, go on. Hi, Ezra. So I mean, that's a great question. I think maybe this question I'll finish with, because this will give me an opportunity to pull things together. Right, we have to finish at one, right? Yeah. So okay, I'll answer that from the perspective of American Jews, and then from the perspective of Israelis. The American Jewish answer is similar to what I was saying before. I think to Shira or maybe to Sarah, I can't remember. It was somewhere over there. about I think that the engagement with Israel as an American Jew offers ways to kind of break open and expand the notion of what Judaism is and what Judaism can speak to in very, I think, exciting ways. So thinking about what should a Jewish economic policy be? What should a Jewish healthcare policy be? What should a Jewish bus or public transportation policy be? Those are, I think, amazing, fascinating questions which force us as Jews, wherever we are, but let's say as American Jews, to kind of think about Judaism in a different way, on a deeper, more expansive way than just thinking about Judaism from the perspective of religious and ritual matters. In a sense, that's a very Zionist answer. I mean, if that's the kind of the core of Zionism is going back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, thinking how can we take Judaism and make it apply to the modern world? And I still think that's an amazing, amazing question. And it's a place that Israel offers us as Jews the chance to kind of grapple with that question in a way that no other place does. So that's one answer, and I can go into more, but that's a regular an answer about from the American Jewish perspective. I think that you know that Israel and Israeli culture, Hebrew culture, Israeli song, all of that kind of stuff. It expands our notion of what Jewishness can be and what Jewishness can speak to in I think, very exciting ways. That's one. The other answer is that as an Israeli, I think that Israel really needs American Jewish voices. I write about this is how I actually end the book, so that's why I'll end the talk as well. I think that Israeli society are doing a lot of amazing things. We're doing a lot of things right. We're doing a lot of things that make me proud to be here and to be an Israeli and to live here. And we're doing a lot of things that are wrong and stupid and going in the wrong direction and taking us in different directions. And by the way, I'm not even talking about the hard issues about the conflict, whatever. I'm talking about it just in all kinds of other day-to-day things. And I think in all those ways, Israel really needs American Jews to help it get on the right track. There was a group of an Israeli philosophical movement in the 1950s called the Canaanites. The Canaanites were a group of stark anti-diasporist, anti-Jewish Hebrews, like Jewish Israelis, but who wanted Zionism to reconfigure Zionism as a purely Hebrew experience connected to the land and not connected in any way to the Jewish past or the Jewish present or to the diaspora. They wanted to recast Zionism as an entirely Hebrew-speaking phenomenon disconnected from the Jewish people and from the Jewish diaspora. Thank goodness the Canaanites did not succeed. Okay, but I, as somebody who believes in the Jewish people and who believes in I think probably even before I'm a Zionist, I'm somebody who believes in the Jewish people. I would not want Israel to fall back into that trap. I want Israel to be a place where the Jewish people are connected with and related to and part of the conversation about what that country and what this country can become. So for that reason, I want American Jews to be involved in it, because the alternative is too terrible to think about. And with that depressing note, it's always good to finish on a depressing note as a Jew. I wish everyone, thank you very much. I'll say the one final thing. A lot of what I do is I try to push the pendulum in this direction and push it too far in this direction. And I hope that probably nobody will end up over here with a pendulum over here. But maybe it might push you a little bit over here. And so think about the pendulum, and I hope that at least I got you to think about things, and I'm happy to continue the conversation, and I'm happy to sell you some books, and I wish you all a wonderful year at Pardes.